are listening to Expanding Horizons, the podcast of the Unitarian Church of South Australia, a home of progressive spirituality and free religious thought and action since 1854. Views expressed in these podcasts are those of the speaker and are not intended to represent the position of the church itself or of the worldwide Unitarian Universalist movement. For more information, visit unitariansa.org.au.
When a cloud is transformed into rain, it is not dying. A cloud can become rain or snow or ice. A cloud cannot become nothing. It is impossible for a cloud to die. It's a continuation. On the same way, it is impossible for you as a human being to die. You too are a continuation. Good morning and welcome to our service of worship. I'm Jenny Dystra. I'll be leading the service today. We are an inclusive community and welcome everyone regardless of their gender preference, identification, ethnic identity or religious persuasion. It doesn't matter whom you love or whom you worship, you will be respected in this space. And especially a warm welcome to visitors and people who have back after a fairly long break, and also to people listening to this service on YouTube. Special thanks to those who are giving feedback to Mary or me. We are new to this game and appreciate the responses. For those of you here, we hope you can stay for tea, coffee and conversation after the service. Our COVID protocols mean you don't serve yourself at the, but you can get what you want from the servery window. Our volunteers are endlessly patient with your exacting requirements. Just half, full, weak, gluten-free, lactose-free, spice biscuit please, and so on. And the mask stays in place until you're seated, nicely spaced of course. Now we're going to begin today with a reading, and it'll be a real treat. It's a wonderful story from Tolstoy.
This is a story about a king who goes on a quest to find answers, and I hope by the end of it you can relate to some of the questions and the answers. It once occurred to a certain king that if he always knew the right time to begin everything, if he knew who were the right people to listen to, and whom to avoid, and above all, if he always knew what was the most important thing to do, he would never fail in anything he might undertake. And this thought having occurred to him, he had it proclaimed throughout his kingdom that he would give a great reward to anyone who would teach him what was the right time for every action, who were the most necessary people, and how he might know what was the most important thing to do. And learned men came to the king, but they all answered his questions differently. In reply to the first question, some said that to know the right time for every action, one must draw up in advance a table of days, months, years, and must live strictly according to it. Only thus, said they, could everything be done in its proper time. Others declared that it was impossible to decide beforehand the right time for every action, but that not letting oneself be absorbed in idle pastimes One should always attend to all that was going on and then do what was most needed. Others again said that however attentive the king might be to what was going on, it was impossible for one man to decide correctly the right time for every action, but that he should have a council of men or women who would help him to fix the proper time for everything. But then again others said that there were some things which could not wait to be laid before a council, but about which one had at once to decide whether to undertake them or not. But in order to decide that, one must know beforehand what was going to happen. It is only magicians who know that, and therefore in order to know the right time for every action, some said that the people the king most needed were his counselors. Others said priests, others said doctors, while some said the warriors were most necessary. To the third question, as to what was the most important occupation, some replied that the most important thing in the world was science. Others said it was skill in warfare, and others again said it was religious worship. All the answers being different, the king agreed with none of them and gave the reward to none. But still wishing to find the right answers to his questions, he decided to consult a hermit, widely renowned for his wisdom. The hermit lived in a wood which he never quitted, and he received none but common folk. So the king put on simple clothes and before reaching the hermit's cell, dismounted from his horse and leaving his bodyguard behind, went on alone. When the king approached, the hermit was digging the ground in front of his hut. Seeing the king, he greeted him and went on digging. The hermit was frail and weak, and each time he stuck his spade into the ground and turned a little earth, he breathed heavily. The king went up to him and said, "I have come to you, wise hermit, to ask you to answer three questions. How can I learn to do the right thing at the right time? Who are the people I most need? And to whom should I pay more attention? And what affairs are the most important and need my first attention?" The hermit listened to the king but did not answer. He just spat on his hand and recommenced digging. "You are tired," said the king. "Let me take the spade and work a while for you." "Thanks," said the hermit. And giving the spade to the king, he sat down on the ground. When he had dug two beds, the king stopped and repeated his questions. The hermit again gave no answer, but rose, stretched out his hand for the spade and said, "Now rest a while and let me work a bit." But the king did not give him the spade and continued to dig. 1 hour passed and another, the sun began to sink behind the trees, and the king at last stuck the spade into the ground and said, "I came to you, wise man, for an answer to my questions. If you can give me none, tell me so, and I will return home." "Here comes someone running," said the hermit. "Let's see who it is." The king turned around and saw a bearded man come running out of the wood. The man held his hands pressed against his stomach and blood was flowing from under them. When he reached the king, he fell fainting on the ground, moaning feebly. The king and the hermit unfastened the man's clothing. There was a large wound in his stomach. The king washed it as best as he could and bandaged it with his handkerchief and with a towel the hermit had. Again and again, the king washed and rebandaged the wound. At last, the man revived and asked for something to drink. The king brought fresh water and gave it to him. Meanwhile, the sun had set and it had become cool. So the king, with the hermit's help, carried the wounded man into the hut and laid him on the bed. Lying on the bed, the man closed his eyes and was quiet. But the king was so tired with his walk and with the work he had done that he just crouched down on the threshold and also fell asleep, so soundly that he slept all through that short summer night. When he awoke in the morning, it was long before he could remember where he was or who was the strange bearded man lying on the bed gazing intently at him with shining eyes. "Forgive me," said the bearded man in a weak voice when he saw the king was awake and was looking at him. "I do not know you and have nothing to forgive you for," said the king. "You do not know me, but I know you. I am that enemy of yours. I swore to revenge myself on you because you executed my brother and seized his property. I knew you had gone alone to see the hermit, and I resolved to kill you on your way back. But you did not return, so I came out from my ambush to find you. Your bodyguard recognized me and wounded me. I escaped, but should have bled to death had you not dressed my wound. I wish to kill you, and you have saved my life. Now, if I live, and if you wish it, I will serve you as your most faithful slave, and will bid my sons to do the same. Forgive me." The king was very glad to have made peace with his enemy so easily, and to have gained him for a friend. And he not only forgave him, but said he would send his servants and his own physician to attend to him. He promised to restore his property. Having taken leave of the wounded man, the king went out onto the porch and looked around for the hermit. Before going away, he wished once more to beg an answer to the questions he had put. The hermit was outside, on his knees, sowing seeds in the beds that had been dug the day before. The king approached him and said, "For the last time, I pray you to answer my questions, wise man." "You have already been answered," said the hermit, still crouching on his thin legs and looking up at the king, who stood before him. "What do you mean?" asked the king. "Do you not see," replied the hermit, "if you had not pitied my weakness yesterday and had not dug these beds for me, but had gone your own way, that man would have attacked you. So the right time was the time that you were with this person. Afterwards, when that man ran to us, the most important time was when you were attending to him, for if you had not bound up his wounds, he would have died without having made peace with you. So he was the most important man, and what you did for him was the most important business. Remember then, there is only one time that is important, and that is now. It is the most important time because it is the only time when we have any power. The most necessary man is he with whom you are. For no man knows whether he will ever have dealings with anyone else. And the most important thing to do is to do good, because for that purpose alone was the man sent into this life. And I believe the same applies to women as well. It's gender neutral.
It's our tradition to share the significant events of our spiritual lives in an open forum of fellowship. I invite you now to deepen and bind that relationship by sharing any recent event that's been significant in your spiritual life. Light a candle from our chalice and tell us briefly about it, and you can light a candle in silence. Listening with an open heart and mind is the most important part of this practice. Thich Nhat Hanh died at his residence in Tu Huu Temple on January the 22nd this year at age 95. His death was widely mourned by various Buddhist groups in and outside Vietnam. The Dalai Lama, the South Korean President and the US State Department all issued words of condolence. His five-day funeral, which began on the day of his death, had a seven-day wake that culminated with his cremation on January the 29th. He wrote, in about 2015 I think it was, "I have a disciple in Vietnam who wants to build a stupa for my ashes when I die. He and others want to put a plaque with the words, 'Here lies my beloved teacher. I told them not to waste temple land.' I suggested that if they still insist on building a stupa, they have a plaque saying, 'I am not in here.'" But in case people don't get it, they could add a second plaque, "I am not out there either." And if people still don't understand, then you can write on the third and last plaque, "I may be found in your way of breathing and walking." What made him so special? He was a Zen monk who also studied the Mahayana and Theravada schools, or vehicles as the Buddhists call them. He was a linguist, fluent in French, classical Chinese, Pali, Sanskrit and English, as well as his mother tongue, Vietnamese. He studied science, psychology, theology and philosophy, and he taught literature, psychology and Buddhist studies in the university in Saigon. He's most famous for being a peace activist. He developed the concept of engaged Buddhism, and he's very famous for bringing mindfulness to the West. Now, his father was an official with the French administration. He was the fifth of six children and lived with his grandparents in one of these extended family setups. He recalls at the age of seven or eight feeling joy when he saw a drawing of the peaceful Buddha sitting in the grass. At age 12, he expressed interest in training to become a monk, which his parents, cautious at first, eventually let him pursue at age 16 when he went into a monastery. When the Vietnam War, or as the Vietnamese say, the American War began, he fell foul of the Catholic establishment and the military junta by advocating pacifism. This made him a traitor and a communist, as far as they were concerned. He trained monks to be pacifist. In 1964, after the publication of his famous poem, "Whoever is listening, be my witness, I cannot accept this war." So because the Americans in the distance are being outflanked, you can be pretty sure they'd be wiped out in that particular encounter. But I mean, it was very nasty. That's the defoliation that occurred there. And of course it went into Laos, it went into Cambodia, and that's one of the things that I can remember being spoken about, that they have the icky sticks, poison sticks, so people fall through that, and the aim is to injure, not to kill, because it ties everybody up and slows everyone down. So it was a particularly ugly war. Now, after he wrote that poem, he was labelled an anti-war poet and denounced as pro-communist propagandist by the American press. In 1965, he wrote Martin Luther King a letter titled "In Search of the Enemy of Man." During his 1966 stay in the US, Thich Nhat Hanh met King and urged him to publicly denounce the Vietnam War. In 1967, King gave the speech "Beyond Vietnam, A Time to Break Silence" at Riverside Church in New York City. This was King's first speech to publicly question US involvement in Vietnam. So he was very influential. And it isn't surprising that the communists were no more fond of him than the South was, which is why he ended up in France, where he established the Unified Buddhist Church and became the chair of the Vietnamese Buddhist Peace Delegation. He wrote The Miracle of Mindfulness for Buddhist social workers in Vietnam because they were living in a situation where there was a danger of dying every day. So out of compassion, out of willingness to help them keep continuing their work, The Miracle of Mindfulness was written as a manual for practice. But after that, friends in the West thought it would be helpful for them, so he allowed it to be translated into English. The book took off in the 1970s. I didn't get a copy then. I didn't get a copy for some time later. It was Barbara Willow, the late Barbara Willow, that introduced me to this particular person. The original mindfulness community set up in the Dordogne was named the Sweet Potato Community, as that was the food that was consumed by the poor in Vietnam. And then another hamlet was purchased Persimmon Village, but persimmons didn't grow very well there. Plums did, hence the moniker Plum Village. And Plum Village is now the largest Buddhist monastery in Europe and America, with over 200 monastics and over 10,000 visitors per year. He didn't abandon activism in Southeast Asia, and he got himself expelled from Singapore by aiding Vietnamese boat people. At the time, both the Malaysians and the Singaporeans would drive the boats back to sea so the refugees would drown or starve. Now, they banged him up and wanted to close everything down straight away, but the French government intervened on his behalf and they undid the rescue operation a bit more gently. But since then, he's been involved always in action against slavery and human trafficking. So you may be getting a handle on what engaged Buddhism means. It means tackling the evils in the world. One major departure of Plum Village from the practice of mainstream Buddhism relates to the position of women. In 2005, Thich Nhat Hanh, Sister Chan Kong and a large delegation of lay practitioners and monastics travelled to Vietnam for the first time since 39 years of exile. During the Lunar New Year celebration, Thich Nhat Hanh stood up in the first row with the many venerable monks. To the great surprise of the venerables, he prostrated himself three times in front of the nuns. Now, it would never have occurred to these monks to show such a sign of reverence to nuns, but they followed his example. Although this was standard practice in Plum Village, the international Plum Village in France, prostrating before nuns was an incredibly powerful, humbling and transformative moment for the monastic tradition in Vietnam. Thich Nhat Hanh, Sister Chan Kong and many other international Plum Village monastics have made revolutionary changes for nuns, creating for them equal status, voice and influence to that of monks. And some of these major changes include ordaining nuns to the same level as their monastic brothers, generally in the traditional Buddhist monasteries. The women don't get full ordination, they get partial because they're only capable of partial enlightenment. It's a bit reminiscent, isn't it, of the Christian thing that women don't have souls but men do. All responsibilities are shared by international Plum Village monks and nuns, both within and outside the monasteries. Monks and nuns are equally responsible for teaching, planning, cooking, cleaning, finances and all the boring organisational stuff. In decision making, their views are equally valued, and it goes into ceremony as well, because in traditional communities the oldest nun is positioned behind the youngest monk in sitting and walking meditations, but at Plum Village they walk side by side. And of course, traditionally only monks give Dharma talks and don't often talk to nuns or women anyway. At the international Plum Village monasteries, nuns and monks alternate giving Dharma talks, and all talks are addressed to the whole community. Today, more than half of the monastic practitioners at Plum Village are women. His teachings are inclusive. He is always careful to interchangeably use he, she, the neutral and the non-binary person and they, which of course wasn't done for many in the Tolstoy story, wasn't it? A bit before Tolstoy's time, wasn't it? While most traditions don't have monks and nuns practicing together, in Plum Village they do, and the arrangement encourages monastics to see one another as brothers and sisters, one of the same family. It reduces fantasy and wrong perceptions about the opposite gender. and helps monastics deal with the sexual energy directly rather than avoiding or suppressing it. Teachings, ceremonies and calligraphy centre around Mother Earth, recognising her as a bodhisattva and emphasising the Buddha nature and teacher are contained within her. For the first time since the Buddha, Thich Nhat Hanh revised monastic codes of conduct for fully ordained monks and nuns. According to the traditional precepts, a monk may disrobe 7 times. Just go out of the monastery and come back in. But if a fully ordained nun disrobed, she could only return as a novice and then never be ordained. So that was another injustice that he reversed. So you can see Thich Nhat Hanh was a man with the courage of his convictions, great education and influence. It won't surprise you to note that he was a vegan as well as a pacifist and a wonderful teacher. Like the Dalai Lama, he does not encourage Westerners to abandon their faith traditions, but rather to listen and learn and incorporate practice like meditation into their own lives. You don't have to learn Vietnamese. This is in stark contrast to the religious practice of many other teachers in many other religions, including Buddhism. In the Rigpa Foundation, for example, you're expected to learn Tibetan after your first couple of years of study. His talks and meditation tapes are very accessible for Westerners, and his book, Living Buddha, Living Christ, written in 1995, is still worth more than a cursory read. His teachings are up to date. Knowing I was preparing for this subject, Mary sent me one called Loneliness and the Illusion of Connection. In it, he points out that after a couple of hours on the computer, you forget you have a body. Now, how many physiotherapists would applaud that observation? He maintains that loneliness is a loss of connection with ourselves rather than with others. After all, you can be lonely in a marriage. You could be lonely at a party. He makes a great case for connecting with your own body, with your feelings, as well as truly listening for others. He has many practical suggestions for achieving this, including making every step from your workplace to the car park as a step toward home, to warmth, to comfort, self-care and ease, rather than mulling over the events of the day. There is no abundance theology. None of that West Coast Buddhism where being present will help you prosper. Rather, attending to yourself is seen as a foundation for reaching out to others and making the world a better place. I'm going to end today's service with some quotes from Thich Nhat Hanh. The real power of the Buddha was that he had so much love. He saw people trapped in their notions of small, separate self, feeling guilty or proud of that self, and he offered revolutionary teachings that resounded like a lion's roar, like a great rising tide, helping people to wake up and break free from the prison of ignorance. We have the tendency to run away from suffering and to look for happiness, but in fact, if you've not suffered, you have no chance to experience real happiness. With mindfulness, you can establish yourself in the present in order to touch the wonders of life that are available in that moment. And finally, if in our daily life we can smile, if we can be peaceful and happy, not only we, but everyone will profit from it. This is the most basic kind of peace work.
Well, we hope you enjoyed this Expanding Horizons podcast. These podcasts are the intellectual property of the presenter. They can be used only with the express permission and appropriate acknowledgement of the presenter and the podcast used in its entirety. This permission can be obtained by emailing Unitarian SA at bigpond.com. Please feel free to leave a comment or visit us on Facebook or Twitter by searching SA Unitarians.